Morning. Did anyone remind people to turn off your cell phones and things like that today? They're all off? Good, good. Then I can read you the principles of not one but two great religious traditions. First are the four holy truths of Buddhism. What then is the holy truth of ill? Birth is ill, decay is ill, sickness is ill, death is ill. To be joined with what one dislikes means suffering. To be disjoined from what one likes means suffering. Not to get what one wants also, that means suffering. In short, all grasping involves suffering. What then is the holy truth of the origination of ill? It is that craving which leads to rebirth, accompanied by delight and greed. Seeking its delight now here, now there, craving for sensuous experience, craving to perpetuate itself, and then craving for extinction, for it all to be over. What then is the holy truth of the stopping of ill? It's the complete stopping of that craving, the withdrawal from it, the renouncing of it, throwing it back, liberation from it, non-attachment to it. What then is the holy truth of the steps which lead to the stopping of ill? It is this holy eightfold path, which consists of right views, right intentions, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Now another great religious tradition, less well known, the principles of the Unitarian Universalist Association. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the rights of conscience, and the use of democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So here we have the principles of not one but two religious traditions. It's going to take time to go through them all. So I just asked you a moment ago if your cell phones were off. You might need to turn them back on so you can call people to let them know you're not going to be home for a while today. This is really... Well, maybe it would be best if I just keep things simple and talk about one from column A and one from column B. Deborah? Thank you. Set us up to expect one last note and then it didn't happen. Just kind of left with expectation. Well, the first holy truth of Buddhism is to recognize the universality of suffering, the realization that all is ill. There's something profoundly wrong here, a sickness. Something's wrong with who we are or how we are, what we see and how we see it, what we want and how we want it, and then with how we think about it all. All is ill. Besides being the first truth and the key to all the other holy truths, it's also the most difficult truth to realize. Some say that only an arhat, a saint, can get it right. The Buddha said, "It is difficult to shoot from a distance, arrow after arrow through a narrow keyhole and miss not once. It is more difficult to shoot and penetrate with the tip of a hair split 100 times, a piece of hair similarly split. It's still more difficult to penetrate to the fact that all this is ill." Our own first principle is this. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. As it is with the first holy truth of Buddhism, our first principle is at once the key to all the others and the most difficult principle to realize and really take to heart. Some years back, I met with a group of UUs to discuss our principles. One was a master of understatement. She said of this first principle, "It ain't that easy." She was from English. Is from England, so it was funny to hear her say "ain't." "It ain't that easy." Someone else added, "If you do it well enough, you're a saint," just as Buddhists say of one who has grasped their own first principle. Someone else said, "It's easy to believe, hard to practice." That arrow went straight through the keyhole. It's easy to believe that affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person is a great plan. It's another thing to put it into practice. To genuinely affirm and actively promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person is not at all easy. These weeks, we see how hard it can become, these recent weeks. It's a radical undertaking, now more than ever. The first radical word in our statement is the word inherent. Inherent worth and dignity are very different from acquired worth and dignity. What is inherent is not acquired. It's not earned. It doesn't need to be proven or even demonstrated. It's not something to be had in exchange for something else. It's not transactional. It has nothing to do with my economic usefulness or yours. Inherent worth and dignity do not depend on age, intelligence, skin color, class, size, or beauty. The word inherent suggests that our worth and dignity begin with a human body, not necessarily a pretty, healthy, or whole one, and a human mind, which also need not be pretty, healthy, or whole. Inherent worth and dignity transcend these conditions. We say that we covenant unconditionally to affirm and promote the dignity and worth of persons, all persons, any persons, all persons, no conditions. Right. It ain't easy. Someone in our group said, "It's hard to convince someone else of the worth of a third party." And everyone agreed to that. Someone else then asked, "Where do we begin if not with ourselves?" Ourselves can mean our own places of worship. Why come to a gathering like this one?
Why are you here today? One answer is that we prepare here to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of the people we meet out there. Has anyone here ever studied judo or karate? Yeah, there we go, gym. So, remember what you call the place where you learn and practice? A dojo. A lot of you folks know that word, a dojo. This is our practice room, our dojo, if you will. Dojo just means the place of the way, the place where we meet to practice something special, where we prepare to take our practice out there by getting it right in here. Our chalice circles that we're needing to start up today will be like smaller practice rooms, we hope. So, okay, where do we begin, if not with ourselves? Ourselves can also simply mean ourselves, just me, the creatures whose skins we're filling right now. Too often we don't begin there or here and find that we have a terrible time going any further. Self-love, self-respect, a sense of self-worth are all easy to talk about, to talk endlessly about, but terribly hard to enact. Who is pretty enough? Thin enough? Strong enough? Wise, brave, careful, or kind enough? Our covenant speaks of worth and dignity as if they should be as free as air or water, but we convince ourselves that each breath must be earned, or that we deserve only so much of the water of life as we have earned by proving ourselves worthy. And if I have to pay constantly for every breath and sip of that water of life, surely you must do the same, and I'm going to be watching. So, of course, it's hard for you to convince me of the worth of a third party. Parties one and two are having no party at all. Speaking of parties and fun, I think that most of us here affirm the freedom to play, to act, to dance, to do theater, skateboard, though not on my steps. And so on. Religious liberals are playful folks. We're likely to say, play it whatever you like, so long as it doesn't hurt others. We bristle at signs that say that play is not or should not be allowed. But with enthusiasm for play comes the danger of misunderstanding. You must have seen the bumper sticker that says, "The one who dies with the most toys wins." Seen that one? It's cute, but acquiring toys, more toys, and moving to higher or deeper levels of play are not the same thing. Chess players, as they move through different levels of play from beginner to grandmaster, do not necessarily acquire more chess sets along the way. Then there's the system of colored belts used to mark levels of attainment in some Asian martial arts. Beginners generally wear white belts. Advanced students or teachers generally wear black. Beyond that, you have degrees of black belt up to 10. But students who attain these degrees do not wear more belts, or bigger ones, or blacker ones. Most martial arts are deeply connected to the spiritual philosophies of Buddhism and Taoism. Effective ways to put Buddhist or Taoist principles into concrete practice. And they are arts, not just forms of exercise or military drilling. One of the most beautiful is Kyudo, the way of the bow, or Zen archery. Have you ever seen that? Ever seen a film of it? I just love the draw. It's just lovely with that thing. And that art abounds with stories of shooting arrows through keyholes or splitting one arrow with another. Anyone learning to practice a martial art is also certain to learn many stories of great players with sword or bow or stick or bare hands. Great players called masters. Well, one summer, I was living in Hawaii doing day labor and trying at night to learn the Korean art of Taekwondo, the way of kicking and punching. Every lesson began and ended with a bow to the teacher and the art itself, and it was punctuated throughout by other bows as well. After a period of stretching, body conditioning, breathing, and practicing the sets of movements, we would usually have a session of free sparring. The instructor would pick the pairs of students who were to spar, sometimes mixing black and white belts, which is really safer than it sounds, since the black belt holders are more able to keep out of the way of the clumsy kicks of the white belts and less likely to punch or kick wildly themselves. Well, one night the instructor paired me with Alfred. He was a very advanced student, about my age. He held, I think, a second or third degree black belt, and he kicked very fast and very high. I'd noticed his kicking for a while and admired it while watching him spar with other students, but I wondered if I couldn't get him on the run with a steady punching attack. We jumped right in. I thought we were doing superbly for a few minutes until our teacher rushed up and separated us. "What the hell are you doing?" He yelled at us. He was an ex-military man. He was scary. He looked at both of us. He was looking right at us, very hard. He said, "You didn't bow." "No bow means no respect. Cannot spar that way. No more sparring tonight, you two." Alfred and I had, in fact, forgotten the bow, which until then I had understood as a formality, a pause for breath before jumping in. I thought we were in fine form, but our great kicks and punches meant nothing to our teacher because we had not bowed. Because we had not bowed, we were just two jerks fighting in white pajamas. And he let us know that that was all we'd ever be unless we began to practice our first principle in earnest. The bow that began and ended every lesson and every sparring session was no mere formality. It is the basis for the whole art, sport, spiritual discipline, and game, which is Taekwondo. Your bow expresses affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of any person with whom you want to play. The other player's bow affirms the same in you and may remind you of something that you've forgotten, that you are worthy of a bow. You are worthy of a bow. The mutual bow might look to passers-by like two people worshiping each other. Before dismissing that awful idea, let's consider the meaning of worship. It comes from the Old English "worth skippa," and it means to ascribe worth or value. It is to say with word or song or gesture that this or that is worthy and valuable. Worship has nothing to do with debasing yourself or becoming dust at the feet of some idol. So the bow does involve a moment of worship, each of the other, a mutual sacrifice of status or position. You remember the kid getting down alongside the rooster, the rabbit? The bow is a way of affirming the profound worth of the players before they enter into a very deep level of play, and of reaffirming it as they finish, no matter how much skill they've displayed. The trick is to keep the spirit of the bow, to keep that spirit with you the whole time that you're playing. That is to promote what you affirm in the bow in every move of the game. I want to suggest to you this morning that our own first principle is essentially a bow from us to the world, to every human being. It's a bow which signals not so much the desire to pass respectfully by as a wish to engage with one another in deeper and deeper levels of play. Again, our hope for the chalice circles, that they'll provide more opportunities for that. But play does not mean simply horsing around in pajamas or otherwise. I don't mean to suggest that the core of our spiritual life is a game with winners and losers. Winning or losing all too often signal the end of play. We're not looking for a stopping point, but rather for a way to continue playing. To play at a deeper level does not mean to increase the energy, the violence, the complexity or duration, or even one's seriousness about the game. Think of tennis or baseball. You seldom get anywhere by swinging harder or more angrily at the ball. The child in our story didn't grab or overpower the animals, but aligned and moved with them. Our way into deeper levels of play is guided by ever-increasing respect for the inherent worth and dignity of the players. Our concern must not be so much with the skill of the others as with the others themselves. I'll try to make what I'm saying clear by talking about the difference between experts and masters. An expert player has accumulated all the necessary skills to outlast both beginning and intermediate players, and now looks to overcome other experts in a contest. Unless the expert is teaching the game for a living, she or he finds little interest or satisfaction in playing with beginners. The most significant play for the expert is play against someone, and only other experts provide sufficient challenge. Experts, in other words, are terribly serious, and so they're not really very playful. A master player is up to something quite different. A master player is just as fascinated with beginners as with experts or even with other masters. A master can box with a baby. You ever do that? You ever box with a baby? Can box with a baby, do no harm, and learn as much as she or he teaches. A master player is not concerned with skills or complex game patterns as things in themselves. A master player cherishes the spirit of play and, above all, the spirit of the players. A master player does not hurry through the bow at the beginning or the end of play, but understands how the bow contains the heart and soul of play. A master does nothing, really, but practice the bow in its infinite forms. I often hear in UU circles stories of great masters from one or another spiritual tradition. People come up to me after a sermon and say, "Oh, that reminded me, did you ever hear about the Zen master or Sufi master or Taoist master who, yada, yada." We're fascinated by the idea of such mastery in the far past or in foreign lands, but have little to say about mastery in our own tradition. I want to suggest that if there is or is ever to be a form of mastery in our Unitarian Universalist way, it must be mastery in practicing our first principle. Respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Respect doesn't just mean to acknowledge or to honor. It actually means to look back. How far back? Maybe that's the challenge in our game. Look back, all the way back. Don't just box with the baby inside you or the baby out there. Send your mind back to the beginning, capital B, the origin of the universe. What's there? What's the model we're using these days? What's the model? A Big Bang, right? A first principle, a first or a principal point unfolding into countless galaxies of stars. So respect means finding their glow in what's around you. Maybe most of all in the people. There's something exactly like a star sitting next to you. What else could there be? The thing is not for them to show it, but for us to see it and know it. That's respect. Respect. Look back. It's game time, deep time, eternity now. Your goal is to find the glow in what you've got around you, within you. That glow. Do know. Here's a way of playing that draws us in and draws us forth. For worth is at the very core of worship. Worth always leads me from myself to others in wonder and brings them wondering my way. My worth isn't something that you can leave alone. Your worth is not something I can just pass by without wanting to experience that something in love or in play. In other words, we're moved together to worship. That's our first principle and our first practice. We come together and we start our practice with a bow. Not a grudging bow or a bow by the rules, a joyful bow, a playful bow. We know it ain't easy. If you can do it well enough, you're a saint. It's easy to